Former Douglas East MHK Chris Robertshaw has a new political vision for the Isle of Man. Describing itself as a movement towards good governance, Future Isle of Man has three core pillars to its thinking. Christian Jones caught up with Mr. Robertshaw to find out more.
What is Future Isle of Man? It's not a political party. Is it a pressure group? Is it a think tank?
It can be both. It's certainly not a political party. And we, the totality of those, that small group involved, will not be standing. We're trying to influence as much as we can the situation we're in now as we approach the next election. Specifically, we're pressurising for good governance, I think is the best way to put it. We've just launched our website. If I may say, it's futureiom.im. And I hope people find the website of interest because it talks about the three pillars which Future IOM believe must be instigated by the government to get us to a better position than we are now. And if you like, I'll just whiz through the three pillars represent really the three problems that everybody knows we've got. One is that our democracy, our democratic process is weakening, and I'm happy to go into detail with you on that if you want. The second thing is that our government is becoming too large, too bloated and too bureaucratic and less focused on frontline delivery. And the third aspect, the third pillar, is all about how we're not getting our high-level strategic thinking right.
Well, first of all, we'll turn to the claims that once each MHK is one in 24, their voice gets watered down, not only by the other voices in the chamber, but also by the civil service, is what you're saying. Is that through lack of a party system, do you think?
No, it's not. It's not that at all. It's the way this sort of suppression of the independent expression of view on the part of MHKs started to develop once the ministerial system came in. And I could go into great detail here, but let me see if I can give you a quick version of it. In the old system of government, MHKs were much more independent in their expression and in their ability to vote. Consequently, when they went back after 5 years and knocked on doors again, they were able to say, well, I believed in X or Y and I voted that way. Nowadays, sadly, when people knock on doors, if they want to stand again, and they're questioned about, well, why did we go in such and such a direction? And why did you not stand up more for what we believe in and why we put you in? The answer so often is, well, I agree with you, but the council, I was outvoted on the Council of Ministers, or I was unable to express myself on the floor of the House of Keys because the Council of Ministers voting system, as it were, suppressed that sort of worthy expression. And I've watched the not the opposition, but constructive criticism within the House of Keys and Tynwald diminish because members increasingly realise, well, look, if it's gone through Council of Ministers, there's no real point in standing up against it. The extraordinary thing about us, our malfunctioning system at the moment, is that matters can now pass successfully through the House of Keys, even though there is not a majority of the members believe in that particular motion or option or whatever. So that's really weakened the whole situation, and the adoption of our pillars would deal with that.
And you've spoken about a growing sense of concern among residents. Are there any specific decisions that have happened in, the past 5 years that have served as almost a breaking point for forming this group?
Well, I think, gosh, I could list a whole load. But, I mean, look where we got to on the 20-mile-an-hour situation, which was not a matter of comfort for people. The words you keep hearing these days is, well, why haven't the public been asked about issues? And they feel, people quite rightly now feel disconnected. Well, the truth is, to some degree, the members of House of Keys themselves are now disconnected. What's happened since the ministerial system came in? And in many respects, it has many good points, but it also has profound weaknesses which must be addressed and must be dealt with so we get to a situation where there's good government.
The way that the Council of Ministers works at the moment, you have collective responsibility. Do you think that that serves as a good driver, or do you think that actually hinders? Because, like you say, most MHKs are independent. When they go into the council, they are effectively part of a party of ministers.
Well, that's how it's imagined. But in reality, what's actually happening and where the control and the authority has gone is it's migrated away from the parliamentary system and away from the people. And it's migrated towards the functionality of the way our departmental system runs. So the real authority and control lies with the bureaucratic process. We're developing a situation here where, as the power of the individual departments increases and the influence, political and democratic influences reduce against that process, the departments are actually getting bigger. There's this constant undercurrent throughout the population saying, well, you know, our government's just getting too big. We're uncomfortable with this. And they're right to say so. But unfortunately, the frontline services are also being drained to some degree to support these growing bureaucracies. And again, the pillars deal with that.
What functions do you think are redundant?
Well, now that's a fascinating question. One of the things I've become aware of as we've been developing these pillars is the degree to which future AI implementation will profoundly change the way our government works. Imagine you and I now, I don't know whether I'll be here in 10 years, but you certainly will. But imagine that I'm lucky enough to still be here in 10 years' time. I think if you and I were having a discussion in 10 years' time, looking back on, okay, what happened? We'd actually be laughing at the way we run our government now. We really would. And as I become more aware of how AI has this extraordinary, powerful capacity to integrate high-quality thinking, it's that will progressively replace the bureaucratic process. That will allow a lot more money to filter through back to frontline services. And government will again become what it's supposed to be, which is providing services to the people. For a number of years now, I've been saying, you know, does the government serve the people or do the people serve government? And unfortunately, currently we're at the latter and we have to go back to the former. And I think the great thing about these three pillars is they form the baseline arrangements or governance processes which would allow the successful implementation of AI. And I think the changes that are coming down the road are so profound and so, I'm going to use the word shocking, that even the big accountancy companies who are starting to embrace where the potential is are themselves shocked by what AI is capable of doing. But one of the fundamental needs of the change in governance that we require is we need to move away from 8 individual legal entities in departments but have those departments sitting under one legal unified entity which will be in the future the Isle of Man government, because right now there isn't such a thing as the Isle of Man government. It doesn't exist. I know that's a surprising thing to say, but the Isle of Man government is a figment of our imagination. So when you're in the Council of Ministers, you imagine that the Council of Ministers are a cohesive group with a single mind, and that is not the case. Each of the ministers are representing the mindset and thinking processes of the departments. And these departments, these operating departments, are producing high-level strategy, which in many respects they're not competent to do in the first place. And secondly, high-level strategic thinking should be cross-departmental. Look at this week. I attended a positive action group meeting where Maria Brideson stood up for over an hour and explained how badly we've been handling our immigration policy. And the three things that struck home to me very clearly were how the three pillars of the future IOM concept fitted in exactly with what Maria was saying. The audience was saying, well, were we consulted in any of this? And the answer is no. The second thing that Maria outlined was the lack of integrated policy across the departments. It was very clumsy and very clunky and disconnected. And so that's pillar two. And pillar three, as far as Maria's talk was concerned, is how was our immigration policy implemented in the first instance? Was it high-level, cross-departmental? And the answer is no, it wasn't. And as it were, well, I've never seen an audience come in with a determination to say their piece. And at the end of Maria Bridgeton's presentation, the whole room was chilled and quietened by the sheer incompetence of how we've developed our immigration policy. If we had these three pillars in place, that wouldn't be happening. Look wherever you like. Recently, our Minister of Department for Enterprise didn't even know what was going on in the hotel sector. The farming sector's in disarray. We've got serious problems with our health service because it's bureaucratic. We haven't learned to understand that leadership really needs to come from clinicians who need to be developed in that way. So we're getting a bigger and bigger government, which is becoming less and less competent. So I do want people to please consider taking these principles to heart, because it's not just about choosing people at the next election, and it's not just about adopting policy. You could end up choosing the right person with the right policies, but because of the way our government is functioning at the present time, neither a good candidate nor good policies would be able to make the appropriate progress.
If people were to listen to that and say, OK, well, you're very critical of the system at the moment and how it's been historically, why not then go in and actually be able to change things? Because being able to change things from the outside is limited. We know that MHKs even find it difficult to change things. Why not go in? Why not stand?
Well, I did. I mean,
but why not again?
I'd been in politics for no more than about 8 weeks, right at the very beginning of 2010, and it was self-evident to me, coming from the private sector, wow, this isn't the way government should work. And after the next election, Alan Bell recognised that I was a forward-thinking person who wanted change to occur, and that's why he set up the Minister of Policy and Reform and said, Chris, will you do it? And I said, yes. And I spent 9 months focused on what we're talking about now. And I took it to the Council of Ministers. But because at that time, the situation wasn't as serious as it has now become, and because the ministers were very comfortable sitting in there, you know, sitting at the top of their departments with 1,000 people saying, yes, minister, no, minister, they didn't want change. At the next election, I wanted to stand down because I was making no progress internally. And I felt so guilty about, I thought I knew what needed to happen, that I stood again in Douglas East. And constituents in Douglas East will remember me circulating a document called the Little Green Book of Government Reform. And I thought, there's no way I'll get in on that. It's about reform. And they voted me in.
That's interesting, really, because a lot of people say Tim Wald and the way it's set up, the tricameral system, the Council of Ministers, how the parliamentary system works, it's designed to stop radical change from happening.
I put a massive caveat on that, because I think more and more people now are understanding, hey, this is serious now. You know, we've been running for 10 years in operating cost terms with a deficit and pretending it's okay because we're pinching money from the reserves. Come on. What they're actually spending is, I don't know how old you are, Christian, but they're currently spending your pension. Now, every week, every month, they're spending your pension. And when they dip into reserves, your pension is being spent by government not getting its its act together. To repeat and start again from a slightly different angle, a more sensible one, I think we're now in such a serious situation that there's a growing awareness that things need to change. But what's, I think, is exciting about is it opens the situation up to allowing AI in the future to be applied to our system and to make sure that it becomes much leaner, much more efficient, and drives a lot more money to frontline services. And something we haven't yet discussed, and that is we need to increase the power of the Chief Minister, and that's dealt with in a combination between Pillars 1 and 3. Pillar 1 concerns itself with the introducing the principle of periodic referenda. The Chief Minister would decide whether or not something needs to be taken to the people. He might have, for example, decided we need to take this 20 mile an hour thing back to the people. But here's the interesting thing. As soon as the Chief Minister decided that he or she thought that something was possibly going to go against the will of the people, and therefore he wanted to interrupt it or stop it for a moment, take it to a referenda, that probably would stop the department from even bothering to go forward, because they would probably know the people would go, no, we don't want to do this. Imagine if we did start to introduce an element of referenda, and there would be advisory referenda, not statutory, because the authority of the parliamentary system must be retained. If we introduce that, it would change how we all think about government, because we'd all be involved. A Chief Minister wouldn't want to have too many referenda, because people would get, come on, they would say, for goodness sake, get on with your job. Stop, you know, bothering us with these things. Too little. And people would say, you know, you're not asking us what we think.
But then let's look at, you mentioned that referenda would be advisory, not statutory. At that point, if the referenda result came back as in favour, yes, let's do this thing, and then Tim Wald and Parliament decided, actually, we're going to go the other way anyway, surely that would create a big disconnect, and people wouldn't be involved in referenda anymore. They would feel it's not worth it.
It couldn't be statutory, and one would have to be very careful how the concept of referendum were brought in. So, for example, if Keyes and Legco were dealing with a difficult piece of legislation, I wouldn't expect the parliamentary process, Tim Wald, to go back to the people at the beginning of the process. I would expect Tim Wald, in the case of a piece of legislation, both Keyes and probably even Legco, to do an awful lot of work themselves, examining, detailing, amending a process. And when they thought they got it to a point that it was appropriate to move forward, but there was a real uncertainty as to whether people were comfortable about it, that would be the point at which it would go to the people. Now, coming to your point, it has to be advisory. It may in the future, if it comes in, and I hope it does, become statutory in certain circumstances. But until such time as we learn how to use it properly and the population become comfortable with it, as it is in certain other countries already, then we'd have to keep it advisory. If the Council of Ministers ultimately got a result which left them deeply uncomfortable and they felt, no, we can't go with this, then the Chief Minister would have to use his or her authority to go back to the people and say, we're not doing this, and this is why. And the argument would have to be powerful. And people would have to respect the fact that they'd voted those people in to make those decisions.
So do you think the Chief Minister should be elected by the people? People that want to become the Chief Minister, they have to say on the doorstep, they have to say, as they're campaigning, I'm going to run to be the Chief Minister, / on election day, you have a box. This is your MHK. Who do you want to be the Chief Minister? You tick a box there as well.
Well, I might surprise you by saying no.
Okay.
Very clearly no. I think a Chief Minister must have the authority and confidence of the House of Keys. I think it is up to the members to choose who they want to be the Chief Minister. They'll have the immediate experience of engaging with the people who are the candidates. it really wouldn't work. It'd be almost presidential. Mm. And part of the whole process of these pillars is not only to improve the democratic process for the people, but it's also returning certain powers back to the House of Keys and to Timwald. And to have a directly elected chief minister would directly contradict that. So no, the authority of the chief minister must come from the elected members who were elected by the people.
Obviously, the current government sets targets for population growth. Does Future Isle of Man support that expansion, or is that part of the bloat?
Future Isle of Man doesn't involve itself in policy. It's not our role to do that. Our role is to assist candidates to understand what needs to change to make government work better so that, ultimately, they arrive at good policy. It should work well for those left of centre, centre and right of centre. It's about good government, mm-hmm. Wherever that takes us.
And how would Future Isle of Man suggest making the Council of Ministers more accountable?
Gosh, that's a huge question. I could bore you now from now till tea time. These pillars, implementation of these pillars and the formation of a unified government would result in the departments becoming much simpler, much more focused and much more directed on frontline services. So the role of each department would only need a minister and, shall we say, call it a deputy minister. That would mean that the departments could no longer overwhelm the vote in the House of Keys. But it would also mean, coming to your question, it would also mean that high-level thinking would migrate to a different position. Now, at the moment, and I've sat in Council of Ministers and I've watched it dysfunctionally operate, where concepts come up through a department, encouraged by the CEO, with the minister in place, whoever that happens to be at that particular moment, and other ministers focused on their responsibilities and saying, yeah, I'll go with this if you go with, I'll go with you if you go with this. And it's no way to deal with really, really important policies. Each department should be laser focused on the delivery of its services to the people and be answerable to, the ministers need to be answerable to that. As far as high level strategic thinking is concerned, that would need to migrate, this sounds really strange, to a body assembled by the Council of Ministers, but focused on high level strategic thinking. And any major decision taken would need to be impacted or consider the operational impact in each department. Back to Maria Meissen, Mundy. One of the points she made was that there was no cohesion between the departments at all as to how that particular policy implemented. So let's take that particular example. If we were dealing with how does our immigration policy work properly, what the Council of Ministers need to do is have a secretariat, if you like, capable of assembling on behalf of the Council of Ministers and with the approval of the Council of Ministers the best possible thinking available, be it the best people off the Isle of Man, on the Isle of Man, come together to assist in the process of formulating really good policy. And part of their role will be to engage with each of the departments to make sure that their thinking was in the right place. When they got to a point where they thought they'd got their thinking as it should be, that's when they would take it to the Council of Ministers. The Council of Ministers are those voted in by the public. They would decide whether they were going to take it forward or not, and then take it to the Keys. But bear in mind that in this structure, the departments are individual departments are no longer able to dominate either the Council of Ministers or Keys or Timwald. So the voice of the people at the House of Keys level would also be more influential. But in that system is also the Chief Minister watching this whole process, engaged with this whole process, and thinking, actually, I'm not sure about whether the people are going to be comfortable, or at that point he could say, people, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to introduce a referendum and we're going to consider what the people are telling us. How engaged would our democracy be then? How good would our strategic thinking be? And how much better would be our operational delivery? And what a great situation to find ourselves in when we try to integrate, as we must, the huge efficiencies which AI will provide us the opportunity to enjoy.
If a voter, any resident at the moment, is disillusioned with the current state of politics, the islands, the way that the system's working, what would future Isle of Man's message be to that person?
Would they please ask their candidates, do the people they want to vote for, have they considered future Isle of Man, and do they understand it? My experience, you know, having been in three houses, was that most people, most of the time, come in for the very best of reasons. But they may have no business background, they may be naive politically, but want to do the right thing. It may take them, the whole of that house, to learn the ropes, to understand not only how it works, but how it's not working properly. By then it's too late. And this growing, quite rightly, this growing sense of dissatisfaction amongst the electorate, that our government's not working properly, will only be solved when the likes of future Isle of Man's three pillars are introduced. So I would ask everybody to ask their candidates, do you understand future IOM? And then interrogate them on it, because this website's available to everybody.
That was former Douglas East MHK Chris Robertshaw talking to Christian Jones. So what do you think? Is he talking sense? And if so, will anyone listen? Perhaps you think he had his chance while he was an MHK and should have delivered then. Is the Manx political system fundamentally broken, or have we just been really unlucky victims of events over the past few decades? For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Mouse and Gay Shock Room. Thanks for listening.